Good morning. You have tuned into another International Connection for another Sunday, and we are in the midst of a radio series on mind control in Canada and the U.S. Last week, we heard an interview with Dr. Stephen Kent talking about ritual abuse allegations against Freemasons. Also, as part of CBC's coverage for Making Up for Lost Time conference, put on from November 94 to June 95 in Thunder Bay by a group called the Stone Angels, we heard Peter Tui, a Mason in Thunder Bay, responding to allegations of Masonic ritual abuse. Also, we heard an interview with Judy Steed about the subject. Today we're going to hear an interview with Lynn Moss Sharman. Lynn is the coordinator of AICS-MC, the Advocacy Committee for Human Experimentation Survivors of Mind Control. And she is also was the coordinator for the Making Up for Lost Time conference. We'll go to that interview now. I'm on the line now with Lynn Moss Sharman, survivor of mind control experimentation and an advocate for other survivors. Welcome to the International Connection, Lynn.
Thanks, Wayne. I'm really glad to be speaking here this morning.
I wonder if you could briefly describe for our listeners what had happened to you. And we're going to get into more detail, but just kind of summarize what had happened to you.
I am a survivor of child mind control experimentation, which was funded by the CIA primarily in the 50s in southern Ontario and in upper state New York. And I grew up in Toronto until age 3 on Elm Street and near the railway tracks, and then spent the rest of my childhood and adolescence in Hamilton.
Just before we go into more detail about what you went through, I'd like to talk to Tom about what you're doing now. You are coordinator or founder of the Stone Angels support group. I wonder if you could talk about that.
The Stone Angels was formed in Thunder Bay in 1993. I had been in therapy myself for quite a long time, and began to come in contact with other survivors of cult ritual abuse at that point, and was able to speak over 60 survivors of ritual cult abuse. Many of them were from Thunder Bay, northwestern Ontario, but a number of them had moved here from other cities in the country. And there was a great need to begin asking for services to be provided for survivors, and we began producing the Stone Angels Journal in 1993 with volume 1 of survivors' writings and drawings. And I've just been working on completing volume 6B on mind control in the modern age. So we essentially began bringing cult ritual abuse to light, and that progressed as we began to hear more from survivors into the dialogue about the mind control experimentation that had in fact been going on all over the country.
And you focused on specific issues with your releases of the Stone Angel information package. Maybe we could talk about the different issues that you've released and what they focused on.
Yeah. Initially, it was and personal descriptions of having gone through cult ritual abuse. And then we began to realize that a great percentage of these survivors had also been involved in Masonic cult ritual abuse. Their father, grandfathers were Masons or Shriners, again, in different parts of the country. And we started looking a lot more closely at that because it seemed to be a common threat. Mm-hmm. And once the presidential hearing had been conducted in Washington in 1995 and the survivors of childhood mind control experimentation came forward with their testimony and that became part of the public record, we were then able to publicly come forward with the information about the mind control experimentation that had been described by certain survivors, and the military connection began to come in there. And again, the Masonic was also a common threat. Volume 6A was the first issue that we devoted entirely to mind control in Canada, and it gives a bit of an historical perspective from World War II onwards. And Volume 6B brings in more experiences, drawings, documentation by American survivors. And it's really curious to see the similarities between the experiences of women and men who were raised in Canada as Canadian citizens, and those experiences described by United States citizens. It seems as if wherever there was an American military base in Canada, we started looking at NORAD and the Doom Line. Wherever there was an American military base, we would then see a string of survivors who had grown up there, if not on the base itself, that part of a community that was adjacent to a military base.
Can you tell us typically how children are introduced to this sort of thing?
Well, there's a certain element of intergenerational cult views, but the common denominator again is usually the father was in one of the armed forces, either Canadian or American. And whether there was a predilection for pedophilia and cult involvement prior to that particular father joining the military is a question that really needs to be answered. The almost all of the survivors, certainly over 90%, describe having been consciously or wittingly offered up the cult abuse and then to the mind control experimentation that followed. This wasn't a situation where children were secretly taken away from their parents during the day or on overnight visits or weekend visits elsewhere. There was conscious knowledge of either one or parents, and they were actively involved in making sure that the child arrived where they were supposed to arrive. It especially devastating. And there's a really big statement that needs to be made at this point in history as well. When we think of the Third Reich and when we think of Hitler and the Nazis targeting or extermination of the other, what happened following World War II is that the survivors who are coming forward are the generations of children who were offered up by their older families.
Now, this is something that is just so hard to believe, how a parent can offer up their own children to this kind of thing. But I think we've got to put things into context here, and what primarily the fathers have been involved in. Now, you mentioned that very often the father is in one of various armed forces, and also involved somehow in cults. Now, what kind of cults are participating in this? And you mentioned the Masonic membership as well. Is that part of the or is the cult part of that structure, or is this operating as a separate?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if we start looking at the people who are the men who are put in positions of power in the military, in the government, in any given municipality, and again I'll say across Canada, and then again certainly across the United States, the white male secret society, the Masons, seems to be a prerequisite for having any sort of, and they've traditionally certainly been involved in the military itself. I believe all but two presidents of the United States were Masons.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan was inducted in the Oval Office in the White House. And certainly the cults are very secret, and practice behind the scenes, so to speak, in Anglican Church, Episcopalian Church, the Mormon Church. A number of churches have come forward. Research has been conducted by Dr. Stephen Kent, a sociologist at University of Alberta, on cult practices, deviant religions, and it is the focus of his work that the Masons seem to be the secret society who come up over and over again whenever cult practices are disclosed by survivors or investigated by researchers.
Lynn, I understand you stayed organized at Making Up for Lost Time conference in Thunder Bay back in 1994, which was really the first conference of its kind and a very important one because of that. What were your experiences organizing the conference, and what did you hope to accomplish?
At the time of applying for a grant application to hold Making Up for Lost Time, it was actually a series of three conferences that began in November 1994 and ended in June 1995. At that point, I had come in contact with over 60 adult survivors of ritual abuse in childhood just here in Thunder Bay alone. And many of the agencies in the city had become fairly open about the number of clients that they were seeing, and everyone was looking for information. What the goal of Making Up for Lost Time was to bring the information and the experiences of survivors and of their therapists as well to a community context, so that people would be able to receive some education and instruction on how to deal with clients, and including children who are coming in with these problems, and also to put it into the abuse continuum in your sense as well, that this was severe childhood sexual ritual trauma, and that it had to be included in the abuse continuum. So in a sense, it was a way of making the information available and to make it safe for people to be talking about it. And it was also really, really, really essential to bring the survivors together. And this was a survivor-driven conference. It wasn't organized by an agency. It wasn't organized by professionals.
What level of community involvement did take place in the conference?
We designed the conference so that it was appropriate for both native and non-native agency workers. Mm-hmm. We had representation and participation from Beendigan, Native Women's Shelter, and now Native Women's and Men's Counseling Unit. They work with children too. The Canadian Mental Health Association, Children's Aid Society, the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons, the Battered Women's Shelters here in Thunder Bay, and we actually received our direct sponsorship from Faye Peterson Transition House, representation from Confederation College, the Refugee and Immigrant Office, the service providers here, Family Services Thunder Bay, Ojibwe Family Services, Geraldton Mental Health Services, Honzaki House, Northwestern Ontario-based shelter for battered women, the Indian Friendship Center, Kenora Sexual Assault Center, the Lakehead Psychiatric Hospital, Lakehead Regional Family Center, Lakehead University, the London Sexual Assault Center, the Ojibwe Tribal Family Services, Minobamwadzuin Child and Family Services, the Ottawa Sexual Assault Support Center, Oakland Place, Women in Crisis, Algoma, People Allied for Change Through Empowerment, the Psychiatric Survivors Advocacy Group in Thunder Bay, the Plummer Hospital Sexual Assault Care Center in Sault Ste. Marie, the Bay Police registered and attended, representation from the Toronto Rape Crisis Center, and representation from the Wanamon Council, which was a reserve, a band health council, who were primarily Ojibwe-speaking people. We had students who volunteered and helped and participated from the Department of Social Work and Psychology, including postgraduate from Lakehead University, student volunteer in the Department of Aboriginal Studies and Social Services at Confederation College. And there was also registration from postgraduate studies in psychology from Carleton University and the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg.
So a lot of these groups were looking for more information to look to inform themselves and to sensitize themselves to these issues. Did you get feedback from them afterwards, whether what they got out of the conference?
Yes, I think the people who attended obviously were people who had come across it in their practice and were unable to locate any information or to concretely receive any validation that what they were experiencing wasn't an anomaly, wasn't peculiar to their own lack of experience. I think a lot of people who have worked in direct service with children, adolescents, and adults, whether it's in addictions or in corrections or in direct crisis counseling, a lot of people have been really quite frightened when their clients start to describe and when they start to describe what has actually happened to them. And the information is so horrifying. I can't imagine how overwhelming it would be to a worker in a small agency or somebody in an isolated area mm-hmm. to hear a client start to describe what had been done to them and not really be able to put their hands on any information or have any peer consultation about this. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's certainly a taboo in our society to begin with. Mm-hmm. So there was a great deal of relief and empowerment and strengthening that that came about in the service providers themselves, and a lot of networking began among them.
And the survivors themselves that attended the conference, how did they feel empowered by the conference itself?
Well, for many of the survivors, and they came from Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, all over Ontario, and New Brunswick, there was attendance from there. For some, it was the first time they had ever attended any sort of gathering where they were able to meet other survivors. And I think one of the most empowering aspects was that a lot of the material was being presented in an academic, in an academic, objective way that survivors came to realize that they weren't alone with their perceptions or their experiences either, but that this issue was being taken seriously by a broader research and service delivery community. And just to be there as a survivor and to see 40 other women and some of the men who were coming forward at that time was tremendously empowering for survivors. And I saw many of them begin to speak for the first time. You take away the element of being crazy, being isolated. I saw some of the survivors begin to give material to students who were seeking information. One survivor actually made a videotape of one of her flashbacks that could be used by three mental health workers out in the region. People began information sharing, and they became less fearful for their own safety as well when they realized how many other survivors there were out there. And there was a great deal of laughter. I have to say that as well. Many survivors are really creative and very bright people who are excluded in many ways from participating in society at large because they have such a hard time functioning. And on that level alone, being able to laugh and to share and to be able to speak the same language with other survivors, it's really hard to put into words what being able to be understood by other people, other women who had gone through the same thing, how much that means.
Yeah, I can imagine that survivors trying to articulate what happened to them in the general public would be met with just incredulousness and find it very hard to come out and speak about it. Approximately how many survivors did attend the conference?
There were approximately 40 survivors who attended each of the three sessions. I was quite amazed at the number of survivors who did attend, because I had seen so much fear, and a lot of it was validated fear. I mean, survivors have ended up in hospital from being stabbed or beaten up. They're threatened and harassed by cult members. It was a very dangerous thing to do, very, very courageous act for a survivor to come to a gathering.
Who else did you invite to the conference to give to speak from the academic world or the therapist communities?
The first workshop that was held in November 1994, the primary presenter at that one was Shirley Turcotte, who's a registered clinical consultant and therapist based in Vancouver, BC. Now, a lot of people know Shirley from the NFB film that she made called To a Safer Place. Shirley is a survivor herself as well as being a therapist. She was born a Native father and a non-Native mother in Winnipeg, where she was raised, and it was a cult setting. She was used for child pornography as well. And Shirley was an extraordinarily early academic speaker. We also invited at that time an elder, Louise Shebegigit, from Sabascon Reserve near Nestor Falls. And Louise was there 24 hours a day throughout the duration of the conference there in the hotel. And she was able to act as an elder and to provide protection and healing for anyone who was having a difficult time or who wanted to seek the guidance of an elder about it. And when I first called through to Nestor Falls trying to find Louise to ask her if she would come and do this for us, one of her relatives answered the telephone. And so the message was delivered to Louise secondhand, in a sense, and we asked if she would come and help the Stone Angels at this conference. And when I went to pick Louise up at the bus terminal, there she was, having arrived on the Grey Goose bus line with her medicine bag and her gym bag with her clothes. And she was really surprised when she met me, because she thought that Hell's Angels had invited her to Thunder Bay to do a healing. And she gathered up all her courage, and there she was at the bus terminal, ready to act as an elder and as a spiritual advisor to Hell's Angels. And we had a really good laugh about that one. I just thought any elder who was prepared at the drop of a hat to come and work with Hell's Angels had a lot going for her spiritually. And then that was followed by the January portion of making up for lost time. And that was a more involved list of presenters. Judy Steed spoke. She had at that point just released Our Little Secret, Confronting Child Sexual Abuse in Canada. And Pam Gummer and Ruth Chamberlain Belagas were the two social workers involved in the Prescott Community Advisory Committee on multi-victim, multi-perpetrator crimes against children spoke as well. And Pam and Ruth had been involved in the case in Prescott where 50 adults were formally charged, and I think about 230 children were rescued from situations where ritual abuse was involved. And all of the adults who were charged were found to be guilty. Pam and Ruth, because of their direct family, child, service agency orientation were very, very important to how to speak to our community itself. They spoke about the procedures they had to go through in order to ensure that the children's best interests were served, the documentation that they had to obtain, the kind of testing that they had to go through. And one thing that really stayed in mind was they had to set up a Quonset hut for art therapy. They needed a really rich facility because there were over 230 children who had been impacted in a multi-generational setting in this very, very small community. Another presenter at the conference in January was Dr. Louise Million. She is a psychologist, and she was the co-author of Breaking the Silence. That was the report on the abuse and torture experienced by First Nations people in residential schools. And that report had been commissioned by the Assembly of First Nations. Another speaker was Dr. Connie Christensen, who is a psychologist at Carleton University in Ottawa. And Connie is a very well-known researcher on the source and the impact of the supposed false memory syndrome, the recovered memory movement. And another speaker was Dr. Stephen Kent, who's a sociologist at the University of Alberta. His presentation was on deviant scripturalism and allegations of Masonic ritual abuse. So Dr. Kent specializes in primarily research and published writings about ritual practices within the Masonic and the Mormon, within the Masonic men's society and also within the Mormon church, because there are many links between those two institutions. And then there was a community panel on the Saturday afternoon, and the panel was about the ethics of confidentiality, who is the silence protecting. The moderator for the panel is Brenda Small, who is a Cree lawyer from James Bay, and she's an instructor in the Aboriginal Studies Division at Confederation College. Her specialty is the concept of Native or Aboriginal law as opposed to the laws, the judicial process that is part of our dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And the panel participants were Carrie Beret, who is a counselor, a therapist at Family Services Thunder Bay, and who has almost 10 years experience in working very successfully with cult survivors, trauma survivors, mind control survivors, and also Constable Ken Davis, who is one of the two-person criminal investigation department at Thunder Bay Police. He and another officer specialize in the area of cult activity, cult abuse as well.